Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, welcome to the Autocar Podcast, my week in cars with Pryor here, Cropley over there. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, mate. How's it going?
Very well, thank you, Steve. I have not seen you since we recorded last week's pod. I have not spoken to you at all.
No.
Lots to talk about, which I'm quite interested in. And also a couple of letters. You'll like this first one. I like this first one very much. Right, I'm doing things slightly on the fly, mate, because I'm not on my usual computer, so sorry for the slight delay. As I bring you a letter from New Zealand.
Oh.
Yeah. Nick Fisher writes to say, "Dear Matt and Steve, I live in the South Island of New Zealand and enjoy listening to the pod. With our power coming from renewable resources and home solar, very common, EVs make sense here, but driving all but the local Kia and BYD is challenging and involves a six-hour drive to go and do them. So I thought you would like to hear that you have influence on the other side of the world."
Wow.
We do like to hear this, Nick. Yes. "I've heard Steve often mention how he enjoyed the single engine BMW i4 and decided to buy one, having never sat in one."
Wow.
"It arrived. James May always said that the BMW 320 was all the car anyone needed, and I hoped the i4 would take its place. There was much trepidation as a car transporter arrived in an empty car park in our rural location and offloaded a dusty brand new i4 that had been shipped 12 hours from Auckland between the islands on a ferry. Having been a keen car enthusiast all my life and read with enthusiasm every time engine advancements such as electronic ignition, turbochargers, etc. became mainstream, the electric powertrain feels like the next logical advancement in development. The car is perfect. Not only is it quiet, rattle-free and powerful, it passes the eyes-closed test for working most functions and of utmost importance to me, makes no annoying safety warning noises when driving."
Wacko. Well, that's so good. I'm so glad.
That's great, isn't it?
But I think it is a good car.
It is a good car.
And by the way, the reason I got keen on it is because I read stuff that you blokes had read, you and the other Matthew had written.
Oh, Matthew Saunders had written, yes.
And so I knew it was going to be okay, and it was.
It's a good car. Yeah, turns out it's a great car. Well, thanks for the note, Nick. That's very, very kind of you. And I'm glad you like the car, mate. That's the other thing. Steve, should we talk your column?
Yeah.
Which starts with... Well, last week was a slight disappointment with a Ford Cougar.
Yeah, however, I was whinging about the ride, wasn't
you
I?
You were, yeah. However, this week, things have improved, have they?
Well, yeah, I borrowed a Puma ST to you know, as a kind of bit of redemption. And, of course, it turned out to be a good car. It's. I still think of you and you, you know, your first offering on the Puma ST. You drove around and said, yep, it's a good car, but it only serves to remind me how excellent the Fiesta was.
Yes. That is unfortunately. It's a shame, isn't it? Because it's a great little crossover and everything else. But every time I drive it, I think, it's not a Fiesta ST, is it?
No. But the thing is, for the fuller figure, it's good. Mm-hmm. And also it's for, it's quite good at carrying stuff.
Yeah.
And in a way, because the roads, every time you turn a corner around here, there's another roadworks or another sort of... thing to hold you up. It's sort of getting to the point where you can't really deploy very rapid performance anymore. Mm. And I just like the responses in that car. You still need to press on a bit because otherwise the ride does strike you as a bit hard, but at least it's well damped.
Yeah.
And when you get stuck in, it goes fine, doesn't it? It's pretty good.
Yeah. I like them. And they feel very agile, don't they? They've got that traditional Ford tuck.
Yeah.
On the way into a corner, if you sort of lift a bit, it feels like it's pivoting around the gear lever somehow, doesn't it? And it's got a very agile turn and feel. I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah. So good to know it's still around.
Yeah. And that sort of suppleness that is sometimes, you know, that they can ride with a real control of the body, yet also knock some of those bumps and lumps aside in a way that Cougar apparently doesn't.
No, it's just uncontrolled.
And some Utahs don't.
The other thing was good is that this Puma is a mild hybrid, whatever you call the one with the integrated starter generator.
Yeah.
And I was getting eventually about 47 mpg, which I thought was good.
That's pretty
good. Because I was, you know, trying to enjoy the performance when possible.
Mm.
So it was good. Enjoyed
that is good,
it. Good car.
That is good.
Thank God.
Yeah, it's not all over.
No, it's not
small,
all over.
Compact, good to drive Ford, which is good news. Back at Christmas, you would have sworn our destiny was located at the end of a one-way road, signposted, battery electric cars, as would I. However, what's changed since?
Well, two things have happened, haven't they? Everybody went to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, where it doesn't seem to be about consumer electronics anymore, except cars.
No, they just call it CES now, don't they? I think for that reason, they're just like, oh, crikey, don't call it consumer electronics. No, don't. It's just CES.
Don't make it sound
like... A lot of car stuff is there, isn't
there? Yeah, there really is.
Yeah.
And Hyundai chose that place to launch a huge Hydrogen Society presentation, and it was all about... creating green hydrogen, moving green hydrogen, storing green hydrogen. There were claims made about how they were going to use this stuff for buses, trucks, and cars, and that this was relevant to everyone. And it was the biggest statement by the Koreans, who have been loyal supporters of hydrogen for a long time, was the biggest statement of all. And the size of it, they were just confident that it was coming, which surprised me, really, because they're quite leading proponents of EVs, aren't they?
Oh, they are, yeah.
And then today, or yesterday, I think it was, which will be last week by the time this is heard, Akio Toyoda stood up and said that, in his opinion, only 30% of all cars would ever be EVs, and that the rest would be hydrogen or hybrid or something, something else. And that seemed to me to be totally at odds with the situation that's been basically forced on us here by the law, you know, by the ZEV mandate and so on. And so there's a lot of debate to go, and I think there's going to be a collision downstream between the people who understand and know the potential of hydrogen and are in control of it, and the people who just want EVs to be the solution and nothing but the solution, as it were.
Yeah. Do you sometimes get the impression that people who want EVs to be, battery EVs to be, nothing but the solution, think in very Western European high levels of infrastructure terms and don't think widely enough about the rest of the world?
Very much so. And I think they also don't even think, you know, Yorkshire Moors or Scotland or you know, places where range becomes important. It is going to be, I mean, it seems to me that a lot of the pollution concerns are about point sources, aren't they, after all? And when you get out into the, I mean, I know CO2 is universal, but even so, a lot of the pollution measures aren't really appropriate in the wilds of Australia where I came from, who the hell cares?
Yeah.
So I think that it just seems to me that that there are going to be numerous different requirements for numerous different regions, middle of Africa. And, you know, it's quite right to say that things are going to vary. What Akio went on to say was that in any case, the consumer should decide and nothing should be forced on only the targets should be forced on the industry.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, that, isn't it? Because last week we talked about Mike Hawes from the SMMT suggesting there should be tax breaks to buy a BEV in the UK, making a compelling argument or a persuasive argument for it. But the counter argument is, why are you forcing people to buy things they don't want?
Yeah. I think it'll change. It would change slowly. You know, in Mike's case, he probably wants the VAT to be halved in a month's time, whereas... I think we're talking about 27, 32, that kind of territory.
Yeah.
But
yes,
it's there's such a lot to go and on the one hand you've got Akio saying stuff like that, and you've got some extremely clever and you know, well-researched people saying that it'll be completely different. There'll be twice as many EVs. You know, that's it's who's right?
It's who knows, mate? Who knows? And I would not put money down on any of the above. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't put money on one way or the other because who knows?
Yeah.
Ultimately, I don't know. Because if somebody comes along with a solid state battery that is, you know, that you can package however you want to, is much lighter and much more efficient and charges much more quickly and degrades not at all, maybe that changes
the
game again.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that changes the game. So who knows?
Yeah.
The only thing I do, you know for sure is that the idea that we are in a sort of energy crisis gets my goat a bit, because so much energy lands on the planet every single day. Mm. I think in an hour, enough solar energy hits Earth to supply all of human's power for a year or something like
Amazing.
That. So you've just got to use it. And then if you're using it and collecting it, then actually the efficiency per se doesn't necessarily matter, because it's totally renewable. The efficiency or relative inefficiency of hydrogen compared to batteries, which a lot of people will tell you is the problem. It's difficult to store, it's difficult to transport, it takes so much more energy to get the infrastructure going and go get a tank of hydrogen into your car than it is to charge a battery with electricity. If the energy is arriving effectively for free and at no CO2 cost, doesn't matter. What matters is efficiency, which is the reason we've all been driving petrol and diesel cars for the last century anyway.
Yeah.
Because it could have gone battery electric in the early 1900s, but it didn't, because petrol turned out to be more efficient. More effective. More efficient for the user, but not necessarily more efficient in terms of energy. And it just, you know, there's so much green energy in the world.
Yeah.
We're just not using it. So the idea that there's some kind of battle and conflict and everything else, there's so much energy. It's enough to, you know, cook us all in everything we wanted.
Yeah.
You know, mad.
Let's collect it. Yeah.
Just use it. Just got to get using it, I think. But anyway, that's me.
Oh, I agree.
But INEOS have got an idea, haven't they? They are great hydrogen producers as part of their chemical thing, and a lot of it they release into the atmosphere at the moment because they don't have a use for it. But they perceive their vehicles, well, they're going to make a battery electric vehicle, but they also perceive that their fuel cell hydrogen vehicles could work in places like Namibia, because you could have a solar station generating green hydrogen, standalone, completely standalone station, requires no other network or infrastructure at all. It would generate, that would, you know, you could standalone station, generate hydrogen, stick it in a car.
Yeah.
Or a truck or whatever you use out there.
It just sounds right, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? There's a certain rightness to that. Yeah. But I guess around here, mate, we'll have a battery electric car and that'll be all right.
It will be for the time being, but God knows, well, see me out, I suppose. Not so much you, mate.
Well, we'll see. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Let's briefly talk before we go to a break. You've had a couple of reader emails, mate, saying,
oh, yeah.
Come on, Stephen, about time to lay out some money.
Into a usual lather about this Range Rover that you and I discussed last week. Mm. 73 car, lived 45 years in South Africa, 45 of its 50 years in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Absolutely solid, rock solid, no rust at all whatsoever. On sale for 55k at Jaguar Land Rover Classic, right? I got into a right lather about it. You saw this car as well, didn't you?
I saw it at Bicester Heritage, and yes, last time I saw you, you were about to go and drive it.
I did indeed go and drive it.
Yeah.
And it was remarkably good. I had one of that era, except mine had done a million miles and was rusty. And this car had much better steering, much better ride, really excellent brakes, even a pretty decent gear change. I was surprised. I think you could drive, you know, if we had to, you know, you and I could get in it and drive to Edinburgh tonight.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the lights are like, but the rest of it, we probably pay £1 million for the petrol, but apart from that, it was good.
Yeah.
So I got well lathered up about it, but I you know, in predictable style,
still
a bit of domestic negotiation going on. Or discussion, shall we say. Discussion. Anyway, But I got some letters from people saying, look, could you just give over, mate? You know, could you just make a decision?
One way or the other.
Because I have strayed fairly widely, it must be said.
It's
Suzuki X90s to Ford Raptors and everything in between.
Yeah, to a 50-year-old Range Rover. But on the subject of, well, let's not talk about whether you're going to buy it or not then. Let's talk about old motors in particular, because a few months ago, but we're just putting the video together now, we headed to Wales and got a load of luxury cars together, included in which was a 1963 Rolls-Royce Silver Cloud 3, wasn't it?
Yep.
And I've just been reviewing the vid today, because it's going to go up at some point in the next week or so, this sort of luxury car group test. The noise levels in the back, that Matt Saunders had our road test noise meter, and in most of the new cars, he was getting a reading between like 54 was the very quietest car, which was a brand new Rolls-Royce Phantom, 54 decibels at 50 miles an hour, and the loudest was something like 58, 59 decibels, which I think might have been in a Range Rover. And the Silver Cloud had a sort of bad seal around one of the windows, but still its noise level at 50 miles an hour was something like 64 decibels only. And I know it's a logarithmic scale, so that is quite a lot more than 54. 64 is a lot more than 54, but actually it's not that much more than a bad super mini today, a really sort of average-ish for the class car. It's not that much louder, and no. It's 60 years old. I could have driven a long way in that car.
Oh, it was great.
It was really lovely, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was.
Visibility is beautiful. Smooth automatic gear shift.
Lovely quality.
Beautiful
view over the bonnet, remember?
Fantastic view over the bonnet. And because the pillars are small, no head restraints, so the person in the back gets a great view out, like the person in the front as well. Just...
The most vintage thing really seemed to me to be the... You know, the seats. Remember, you went over a bump in the seat and this... Rather than... helping you absorb the movement, body movement, it kind of amplified it a bit in the way old cars used to, because people didn't get to grips with seat harmonics till a bit later.
Yeah, there's sort of a certain spring. There's probably real springs under there, aren't there? You have a little secondary settle after the car has settled.
It was still brilliant, wasn't
still
it?
Still fantastic. And you could see how something like that, which I think has been in, it belonged to our former contributor Piers Ward's family, didn't it? And you can see why you'd keep something like that in the family, use it a lot. You know?
Imagine how it must have been when everybody else went around in a Hillman Minx with all of the timing chain rattle and sort of goings on from the front suspension and gear whine and God knows what. It must have been a miracle.
Must have been, yeah. Must have felt great.
There were some of those that the differences between very good and very bad in those days were much greater, I think, than they are now. You know, I always look at an E-Type 961 and think of all the junk that was around at the time. What that must have made people think, must have just seemed like an utter miracle.
Mm-hmm. That's cool, isn't it? There isn't quite that. You're right. There isn't quite that level of. There's quite that leap now, is there?
No,
you just don't get it.
Because you find yourself in a really good super mini now, and it wins a lot of respect, I think, because for even things like refinement and steering precision and so on.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to do a few miles over the next few days in a Porsche 911 for a job, but knowing where I've got to go, I could just as happily be in that Ford Ranger Raptor that I've got at the moment, but I would also be just as happy, and actually in terms of parking it somewhere when I get there, in a Kia Picanto.
Yeah,
you could just, and any of those, you do this sort of, I don't know, 400 miles, whatever I've got to do by Monday of next week, and go, yeah, fine, no worries.
Your espousing of the Wild Atlantic Way, you know, with you went over there in the Africa Twin and then the Kia. That's spread now. I've got my son and I are going to do that on motorbikes in the spring.
Super.
Because of you, mate.
Excellent. Excellent. And you're going to go to the...
Yeah, we'll go to the
Seaplane Museum.
Seaplane Museum.
I want to know about that. Because I want to know if it should be on my list. Because I will go back at some point this year. I don't know when yet, but I will do that. Anyway, Steve and I are going to take a short break, and we'll be back with a bit more My Week in Cars in just a moment.
What car would you buy if you could buy any car? What car would you buy if you knew you could save thousands? What car would you buy if you could compare the latest offers from approved dealers? What car would you buy if you could do all of this in one place in just a few simple clicks? And where would you go to buy that car? What car? Car buying made easy. Visit whatcar.com to buy your next new car.
Welcome back to My Week in Cars with Pryor and Cropley. Steve, we've got a letter from Kieran Hecht who says, 2 points, utterly unrelated. First, my frustrations of EV ownership. My Citroen EC4 is 15 months old and I've done 15,000 miles. With eco mode engaged, when it was new, the range showed 225 miles with a full battery. And I would reasonably have expected 160 to 180, depending on the route and the time of the day. However, now the battery will only charge to 97%, and at that charge shows approximately 180 miles, at best giving me 130 to 140, recent cold snap notwithstanding. Fortunately, the car is leased and will return to sender in another 12 months, and I will probably get a new Renault 5, which will be cool. But if I'd bought it outright, the rate of deterioration would be a concern. It's not good enough. What will it be like in another few years, and what would that do to its residuals? According to some of the forums, other Stellantis EVs with the same drivetrain are similarly afflicted. And there's an 8,000-mile service interval.
Wow.
I didn't know that. My experience of some of those earlier Stellantis EVs, the range wasn't great. Did you run one?
No, not. Don't think so. But the thing that I would want to do is get back to the date. To the has he run it right through the a year yet? Because I would want to go back to where I came in, as it were,
yes,
just to see.
15 months. Yes, 15 months old. Okay. He's done 1,000 miles a month in that time.
Yeah, it doesn't sound good, does it?
Because it doesn't, does it? But it should be warranted to a decent extent.
Although they talk about 80%, they only get interested when these things fall to about 80%.
Yeah.
And 80% is losing 20%, a bit of a disaster when the thing will only do 220 anyway. No, it doesn't sound brilliant, I must say. Let's hope they improve. But he seems to me to be proving the sense of doing it on a PCP or a nearly steel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because it will go back, it will be, in another 12 months, it will be 2 and a bit years old.
If I were going to invest proper cash money, the only ones I think I would buy at the moment would be the Koreans, just because of the length of the warranty. Because it seems to me that, the experts that we speak to away from the microphone, as it were, tell us that they are very advanced. Their quality is very good, and of course they've got the warranty, 7 years for Kia, 5 years for Hyundai. I think that protects you.
Secondly, says Kieran, I'm fortunate enough to have a mid-engined manual six-cylinder car for high days and holidays that I intend to keep until I can't get out of it. However, it struck me recently that most learners will now take lessons in automatics or EVs at some point. And what happens to a generation that only have automatic driving licenses? I think, and I might be making this up in my own head, but I think at some point I've heard somebody say, you will just take a driving test and that will probably be in an automatic, but you'll just get a license. And then if you want to drive a manual, it's assumed that you'll work it out.
You'll learn how to do it.
You'll know what you're doing, because actually only people who really want to will do it. A bit like a trailer test. They introduced the trailer test for a while, didn't they? And they've now binned it off.
Yeah.
Because they've just gone, if you want to reverse a trailer, you'll probably sort it out.
Yeah.
You'll probably care enough to do it.
Hit the fence a few times and then you'll know.
Yeah, exactly. So that would be my inkling on that, Kieran, is that, that if people want to drive manuals, you'll just... Because they don't do a separate test for Model T Ford Speedsters with the throttle in the middle, do they?
No.
It's just assumed, if you want to drive a Model T, you'll figure it out.
I think that's all right too, myself. Yeah. I mean, we know these days, here we are standing in a storeroom, 10 feet from a whole bunch of test cars, and I'll bet you out there they're all self-shifters or electric.
Oh, I would think so, yeah. Oh, there is one Mazda MX-5 out there at the moment. But beyond that, I reckon, I think pretty much everything would be... self-shifting.
And the Mazda MX-5 is so intuitive that you could hardly fail to drive it well,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly. But yeah, it'd be interesting to be a bit more like the Americans, where, you know, it's unusual for people to drive stick,
yeah,
or know how to drive stick. Yeah. But I suppose there will come a point where you don't. I'd be intrigued to know what the percentage is of people learning in an automatic, passing a test in an automatic.
Yeah, we probably should find out.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know that. Somebody will know that, won't they? One of the driving schools will know that, presumably. Yeah.
Maybe somebody listening in will tell us.
Yes, could.
If you know the story, drop us a note, will you?
Yeah, I'd be intrigued to know. And also, if I'm making it up about the automatic license merging together, the licensing thing merged together. Let's talk about the Detroit Motor Show, which is going to come back, is it?
Well, they're moving it back to January. Mm-hmm. There was this ritual in the olden days when we used to come back from Christmas, or often even, you know, earliest days of January, January 2, January 4, you'd be on the old Whitebird, head to Detroit, and there'd be, when important European cars were launched in America, with more razzmatazz than happens now, they would choose the Detroit show to do it because it was down the street from GM and Ford and the rest of them. And I used to enjoy that. And, you know, I love the snow and I like the Yanks anyway. And Detroit is a fantastic place. It looks a little bit like Chicago shrunk. Mm-hmm. And it was just a thoroughly good do. And obviously you'd had your Christmas break, came back with a load of stories, met a lot of people. It was good. So if it comes back, it'd be great. But I don't know whether it would ever have the traction that it used to. It used to be a really important international
thing. It used to be the thing, didn't it? It was one of, three or four big shows over the year. Would it be the biggest? I suppose it would.
No, Geneva. I think it went Detroit, Geneva, and then, Paris, yeah, Tokyo, that sort of stuff, didn't it? And then the Chinese shows started to
gain traction. But now we end up with things like CES, which is also in January.
Yeah. A week later, isn't it?
Whew, that's difficult then, isn't it? One of the beefs people used to have about the British Motor Show is it fell quite close to Paris/Frankfurt, didn't it, I think?
Yeah.
Is that right? When it was in October. And it was like, well, there's already quite a big motor show out there, so if you want to do big debuts, where are you going to do them?
Yeah.
And, yeah, that strikes me as poor.
Yeah. I think Detroit will turn back into a kind of regional show, which is all right, because Detroit is still, you know, the headquarters of an industry that sells 15 to 17 million cars a year. Mm. In the US, and a lot of them, I mean, some of them are European and Japanese and the rest, but a lot of them are made in America, so it's still important. Yeah. And
people say about the Brussels Motor Show, don't they? Manufacturers like it, or importers like it, because people buy cars there. It's actually a decent place to sell cars. It's not just a place to see new metal. It's a place where people can come and see a car that they're interested in and maybe buy it.
Yeah, it is interesting the way they've all got a different profile, haven't they? Mm. I mean, they launched it, if I'm right, I think they launched the Land Rover in Brussels.
Oh, really?
1948, yeah.
Cool.
For reasons not obvious. But they've all got a different profile, haven't they?
And what about Geneva?
Well, Geneva's going ahead.
Yeah.
We know that Renault will be there hot and strong, and they'll launch the 5, the production version of the 5, which obviously been lots of ads already, but the production version will be there. And there was talk that we might even see the Alpine version of that car, the R290, a bit beforehand. So I'm not quite sure how that'll play out. But anyway, the problem is that lots of people aren't going. You know, JLR aren't going. Ford, I don't think, are going. Stellantis certainly aren't. And Stellantis are, what have they got? You know, 8 or 10 marks
at
least.
A lot of brands on there.
So it'll be Renault and the Chinese, which is all right, I think, probably from Renault's point of view, because they'll be the sort of friendly face.
Mm.
And it will be a really big deal, the 5, anyway.
Yeah. Are you going?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, good. That's the plan.
Yeah. I don't have a plan yet. I mean, it depends how many new models are arriving, I think, because we'll do a video if there are lots, and we won't if there aren't. So I don't know if I'm going yet or not.
I believe in the next few days there's a press conference about where they're going to reveal who's coming.
Okay.
And I think that'll tell us a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, you need to
plan around
with
the
vid, don't you?
It's just at the end of February, isn't it? I think it's like the 27th.
Yeah, very
and
end.
And then it opens to the public the 28th or something. So.
Yeah, and straight after that, I'm going to come back, get on my motorbike and go around the Wild Atlantic Way.
Fantastic. Are you going that early in the year?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, are you going? That could be chilly. Could it still?
First week of
right?
March. First, yeah, it might be. Be right. Might be, but,
short
hops, pub.
Have you got heated clobber?
No.
Heated grips?
Got, yeah.
Yeah.
Got pretty good, long johns. Pretty good. Also, I'll be on a Honda 750 with that, which has got quite good weather protection. So,
okay,
I'll be all right.
Good. I will barely have started riding at that point. I think for the year, and I should ride more in winter. I was speaking to one of our colleagues earlier, Alan Muir from Wattcar, and he's riding to and from the office most of the time when he comes all through winter. And he said it was only a little bit chilly last week, when it was chilly last week, wasn't it?
It was probably
like -5. But and he said, Pryor, you tell me, because you have some heated motorcycle gear. And I said, well, I've got this like heated body warmer thing, but I don't ride really in the winter. I sort of stop in October until about March. And he was crestfallen. He's disappointed in me.
Uh-huh.
He was genuinely disappointed in me. So I thought, okay, I need to pull my socks up a bit and do it.
Well, I tell you what, around here at the moment, there's so many damn roadworks that you need a motorbike.
Yeah, it would make a difference.
Half an hour of time I'd rather have back messing about with all that.
My thing is that if I spent a lot of money on heated motorcycle kit so I could ride all year, one of the things I like doing is riding to the airport, because you can park next to the terminal for nothing.
Yeah.
And you don't have to worry about traffic at 8 o'clock in the morning.
That's a really
important. You know how long it's going to take you to get to the airport. So that's what I like. But I feel pretty confident about leaving my motorbike at the airport without it getting nicked, because I think it would be pretty ballsy for somebody to turn up in a van and take stuff out of there. But I wouldn't feel quite so good about leaving several hundred pounds worth of heated kit on my bike.
No.
And I wouldn't take it with... I'm a bit of a hand baggage sort of bloke. I wouldn't take it with me.
Oh.
So I don't know how I feel about that.
No, I think you just got to get cold.
Yeah, I think that's the way. It's quite a long way from my... Because I'm not sure I'd get...
Oh, yeah,
I'm not sure I'd get warm over a bun in the airport terminal. I'm not sure I'd be warm by the time I got home again.
No,
but
good point.
Anyway, was I going to talk to you more about motor shows? Yeah, there was only to say, I think there will be some people within some manufacturers who are pleased that their manufacturer is not at Geneva, because they spent decades being fairly well stiffed on hotel room costs
and
show costs and everything else. And when it was cancelled the first time, unofficially off the record, a couple of them going, yeah, pretty pleased about that.
Yeah.
That's, you know, we've been absolutely taken to the cleaners by these hotels that you have to book five nights or whatever, and they're at X £100,000 over the thing.
Shocking, really.
So, you know, if it doesn't work for them, tough.
Yeah.
Good. So I can see why they're reluctant to come back.
Yeah.
Some of them.
Yeah. I think they've discovered the joy of being in control of their own their own news release. You know, with the thing that happens at a motor show is that you scuttle from one to the next, don't you? And you don't, I don't know, I mean, you may have a clearer head than me, but I never feel I do justice to any of them.
No.
And so, in a way, I prefer this business of people designing their own reveals.
Mm. I mean, in terms of, I know this is a bit, you know, what we do centric rather than customer centric. I don't know how many potential customers go and buy stuff at the Geneva Motor Show as a pub. It's an interesting show for the public, isn't it? Because it's quite compact.
Yeah.
Most of the big stuff was there. So if you are a public show goer, then it was the nicest one.
Yeah, we used to we did have correspondence, didn't we, from people who would get the the early flight over because the PAL Expo, the exhibition centre is, what it would be, half an hour's walk from the from the air terminal, and you can just walk in, wander around till you're jack of it, and then go home.
Yeah,
and I think for a day out, it's pretty good.
Mm.
But it may not be quite the day out this year because the cars on offer may not. Well, it won't be a comprehensive selection for sure.
What about the high end? Do you know much about the high end stuff? You know, the supercars, the rare stuff, the kind of stuff that actually always did very well at Geneva, the kind of weird, we're going to sell five of these at
£800,000. I think you can expect some of those, but the ones that are aligned with a group won't be there.
No.
And that tends to be the biggest selling and the most reputable.
And the most credible of those. Yeah.
So I think that the to use a excellent cliche, the jury is out.
Well, we will find out by early March. We will know.
We will.
One way or the other. Finally, mate, tell me about Palmer Sports' Jonathan Palmer and Ginetta's Lawrence Tomlinson, who have joined forces to launch a new thing.
I'm impressed with these two blokes. They're both very well off. They're both extremely successful in business, have other businesses. But they love motorsport, and it seems to me that they are always doing things that are to the benefit of cars and motorsport. And they could be, I mean, Jonathan Palmer owns a lot of property. He could be developing it and putting 200 houses on it.
Yeah.
And Lawrence Tomlinson has, you know, medical supply businesses and all sorts of things. But their concentration seems to be on improving British motorsport. Mm. And this plan is to get hold of a maximum of 64 people who pay £1,500. They go to Palmer Sport and they do what amounts to a Palmer Sport day. So one of those days where you know, it's this kind of never-ending cloud of tire smoke where you drive about six different cars at absolute, you know, and you're encouraged to drive them absolutely flat. You're assessed by two really excellent instructors, two of the best instructors, it says. And you get your chance to be the one person who will be sponsored right through a Ginetta GT race series, 21 races, I think, and, you know, all the testing you need and so on. All you got to do is pay for your accommodation and, in effect, your sustenance.
Mm.
And I just admire the fact that they're always thinking of ways to boost it, and they don't have to do that. And you know, lots of people have got bones to pick with a pair of them, but the fact is they're admirable people, I think.
Yeah.
And the world needs them.
Mm. Yeah, I agree, mate. I agree. Ginetta's great, I think, as a company. I really enjoy what they do in a way that they get young people in. I mean, motorsport is expensive at every level, but you know, they are giving a more affordable than most way to go racing.
Yeah, and they love talent, don't they? You know, somebody does well. Lawrence Tomlinson is full of admiration. He's you know, he loves driving fast himself, but he sees his job as being to bring people through. And you know, I'm sure it's good for business, but there are possibly other ways of turning a quid than that. And
there must be more easy ways of turning a quid than anything in motorsport, mustn't there? It's not an easy business to be in, is it? It's not the profitable arm. You wouldn't think of all of the LNT industries.
You wouldn't think
it's the most profitable.
Yeah.
Because it owns Blyton Park now, doesn't it? Is that right, Ginetta?
I think so. Yeah.
We did chat to him at some length when they made the G60, redeveloped the G60, which had previously been the Marcos. Was it sold as a Marcos? I'm not sure if it was sold as a Marcos, but it's a mid-engine V6.
That was right.
Chris Marsh and somebody else had designed together, and somebody's going to write to me. Somebody's going to be screaming at their radio now, going, "Come on, you idiot!"
Well, I did some miles anyway, with Lawrence in one of these.
Then that Lawrence took on the project, called it the G60, and I spoke to him. I think it might have been at the Goodwood Festival of Speed once, and about it, And he said, "Oh yeah, people think I'm just some idiot who flies around in a helicopter and makes those noises. But we're really serious about this sort of thing. But we've had to redevelop it from the." I said, "What's different?" He said, "Everything back from the number plate."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, would it have been easier to just design a new car?" He said, "It probably would have been, but we wouldn't have done it."
Yeah.
"But we wouldn't have done. Yeah, we wouldn't have done it that way." And credit to him, mate, for going at it. I think.
Also, I just like the fact that he doesn't waste time talking to people that don't matter in this. They're very self-contained, Janetta, aren't they?
Mm.
They know their market. He's brilliant at understanding his market, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
And the same goes for JP, of course.
Yeah.
No, good luck to them. More power to their elbow. We need more people like
that. Yeah, and I'm intrigued to see what comes out of that as well. Who's quick?
Apparently, the what happens is that the 64 get assessed.
Mm-hmm.
It comes down to two. The two best
right.
go to one of the Palmer Sports circuits and do a shootout. And they drive several different cars.
Oh, interesting.
So you really... whoever comes through is going to be handy.
Yeah. How much detail do you know about the process of getting 64 down to two?
Only that they will all be... They'll all do what amounts to a Palmer Sport day or a couple of them. You know how you go along there and... My son went for one. You drive... at least eight different cars, you know, that little thing that looks like a Le Mans racer and the various mad cars, including a Janetta. There are various Janettas on the
on the fleet.
On the Palmer Sport fleet.
Oh, that's cool.
And carts and all kinds of stuff. And you just get watched. And as when we're watching somebody do journalism, you know, it's pretty clear soon who can do it.
Mm.
And I think they've got experienced eyes watching.
Yeah.
But they will also coach people.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. The idea is not just to say, off you go and stand back. It's they want to give everybody a proper chance. Yeah. And that another way I admire them. They're both people who love talent. I really admire that.
Did you ever report much on the Gran Turismo Sony PlayStation, what did they call it? The sort of gamer to racer challenge thing, or what's it called? Jan Mardenborough was one of the first winners. Lucas Ordonez was, I think, the first winner, and he eventually won his class at Le Mans. You know, because they were. It was Darren Cox.
That's it.
Put the GT Academy. It was called Nismo GT Academy. Nissan put some money in. Sony put some money in. But did you ever report on see the process?
No, I just all I ever did was. Read the stories.
It was good. I reported on it a couple.
Did you have a go?
Did I have a go? I did some of the stuff that they do, but mostly I just reported on what they were up to, and it was anything from sort of fitness levels. And they were like, "Well, this isn't a fitness test, but the fact is, we've got these people. They've won some races online. They're all coming in, and they know that they've won races online, and now they're going to do some real stuff. We're not picking the fittest, but." It stands to reason that they know they're coming here.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be beyond them to do a couple of push-ups first, you know.
Yeah.
And then there was sort of some of the sort of auto test stuff, whether you do the drifting, and some of the later stages, they would take three or four professional race drivers and send them around a circuit at a particular pace, start their hopeful at the back and see how far they would get up the field in, say, 4 or 5 minutes. And these racers would all drive effectively to the same standard, the same level, the same thing. And you could see who was, you know, who was good, who was not, who had a bit of racecraft. Because I think that's one of the things that was harder to teach. Because you can, you know, some of these drivers could be very quick, for real, out of the box. But what they don't have, because they hadn't been karting since they were eight, is the actual racecraft about getting past people and stuff like that. But Darren always believed, still does, that there are a lot of people out there who could be very quick at driving cars, but who don't have the opportunity because they don't have the money. But they might be doing it virtually and be getting many, many hours of good practice at driving because the physics models in simulators are so good that you can find people who are really quick and train them and coach them in a way that a lot of race teams do not train youngsters.
Is he still active in all this, Darren?
He's moved on to some other stuff, but he did... I don't know if he still... He did have a virtual race team at relatively recently, but I don't know if he still runs that or not. But yeah, he was running stuff for Mercedes AMG Formula One, had a virtual team as well, and he was involved. He's still involved in that field, I think. But
a really smart and my
really
ideas.
Smart bloke. He's into all. Yeah. He's into a few different things, and they all do well.
I had no idea that the two things could read across quite as clearly as they did with the likes of Martinborough.
Mm.
So very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, really interesting.
But of course, nowadays the old F1 teams spend half their life on the simulator, don't they?
They do. Yeah, they do. Yeah. Actually, there's a good story in the mag this week about road car simulators from Richard Lane. And actually, in my column, we haven't got much time to talk about. But yeah, I wonder if that Ford Cougar you tried last week, if there had been more simulator use when that car was developed 8-9 years ago, whether actually that car would be a bit better.
Yeah.
Because it ended up with anything from a lightweight petrol engine car weighing 1,500 kilos through to a plug-in hybrid weighing basically 1,900. And, you know, actually, if you spent more time
on the
simulator.
Funny weight distribution,
if you spent more time in the simulator in its early days, maybe that would have done it a favour.
And then I think the other thing that came through, not from official channels, was that the tyre and wheel selection on the car that we were in was done more for marketing and, you know, nice brochure pics reasons than good behaviour. Yeah. So lots of things get in the way. But that car finished up feeling as though it was on some other suspension that had, you know, been picked up along the way.
Yeah.
Anyway,
there we go. That's all for me and Steve this week. Thank you, mate. I'll see you in a week's time.
Yes, sir.